I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. President George Bush wrapped up his trip to former Soviet Union states today, and he did it with one more jab at Russia's President Vladimir Putin. In a speech to tens of thousands of Georgians at an outdoor rally in Tbilisi, Bush praised their people's revolution of a year and a half ago, although his words were clearly intended for ears in Moscow as well.
You have taken tough steps to reform your economy and to crack down on corruption. You are building a democratic society where the rights of minorities are respected, where a free press flourishes, a vigorous opposition is welcome, and unity is achieved through peace. In this new Georgia, the rule of law will prevail, and freedom will be the birthright of every citizen.
But the praise for Georgian democracy is also criticism aimed at President Putin's Russia. In recent years, Putin has stripped away the rights of the media, canceled free elections, and refused to push ahead with some economic reforms. And yet on this same trip, Bush played a key role in Putin's showcase of Soviet-era strength as part of the celebrations to mark the anniversary of the end of the Second World War. So today we're asking, just what's changing in relations between the two countries? Does Bush need to take an even tougher stand with Russia? Or is it enough to raise his points of criticism from neighboring countries? Maybe you think that Bush is going too far, running the risks of alienating a very large and very powerful former enemy. Where is the line to be drawn? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're starting today with Peter Baker. Peter is in Tbilisi. He's a former Moscow correspondent who now covers the White House for The Washington Post. And he's on the line from Georgia's capital. Hello, Peter.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, thanks. I'm interested in your take on Bush's time in Tbilisi. It sounds like he had a pretty hearty welcome from the people there.
Well, it was a pretty heady day for the president. He got the kind of welcome he doesn't often get in Europe these days. Many European countries, of course, are quite ambivalent about him, but not Georgia. They see him as a guarantor of their fledgling democracy and their independence from a rather aggressive and sometimes bullying neighbor to the north. So they turned out in great, great numbers today with great enthusiasm, and I think he really responded to it.
Peter, I want to ask you about one line that the president delivered in his speech. The line is this: the sovereignty and territorial integrity of Georgia must be respected by all nations. Why is that so important?
Right. He says all nations. What he means is Russia. Because right now, Georgia is still a fractured country. You know, it emerged from the old Soviet Union, divided by old ethnic animosities, and there are two little republics within the state, Abkhazia and South Ossetia, that have broken away. And with Moscow's support, Georgia's new president, Misha Saakashvili, would like to reincorporate them into his country, rebuild his country as a whole. But Russia has stood in the way of that for a long time.
I'm interested, Peter, because of your perspective working on both sides of this story. Do you think perhaps that the Georgians are putting too much faith in their new ally, the United States, hoping perhaps for more support than they're actually going to get?
Well, that's certainly possible. I mean, I think President Saakashvili today wanted an enthusiastic commitment that Georgia would be on the path to NATO membership, for instance, and President Bush was much more lukewarm, I think, on that. You know, there's only so much the president can do on these types of things. But on the other hand, Washington is going to be their best friend, I think, in the coming future, and it's important for them to cultivate that relationship.
All right, Peter, thanks for your time. Safe travels home.
Thank you very much.
Peter Baker is White House reporter with The Washington Post. Next to Fred Weir in Moscow. Fred is a correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor and often helps us out in understanding what's going on in that country. Hello, Fred.
Dick, hi.
Tell me what the Russian perspective on this visit was, because as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, we seem to have two very sort of contrasting images of President Bush. On one hand, there he is on the reviewing stand looking at the Russian military going by, and on the other hand, he's sniping away at Putin from neighboring republics. How is it seen there in Russia?
Well, much of the sniping didn't get seen in Russia, and I think the Russians are pretty pleased at the way it turned out. Putin wanted a big party with the world coming to him to honor this Soviet victory 60 years ago over Nazi Germany, and by and large, he got it. Nobody really raised a fuss in Moscow. And although the Russians are disappointed by the things that Bush said in Latvia and today in Georgia, everybody in this country knows that if you're going to declare responsibility for the Soviet victory in World War II, that's a really mixed bag, and it's going to rouse controversy. By and large, that controversy did not erupt in Moscow, and they're happy about that.
I'm interested in where you see this going, though, Fred, because when the U.S. president comes that close to Moscow and raises that kind of criticism, is that ever going to be seen as provocative by the Kremlin?
I think that they are not happy about the tendencies around the periphery. They're panic stricken about the tendencies on the periphery of Russia, and they have no strategy on how to deal with that. And yes, when the American president comes to these places and takes the side of the rather one-sidedly the side of those countries in the Baltics and here in Georgia, this is very bothersome to the Kremlin. And they have not got an answer for how to deal with the unraveling of the former Soviet space.
And there are other international issues that you know well where the U.S. and Russia disagree. It has to do with Russian support for countries like Syria or Iran or Iraq. When you have the Russian president and the U.S. president doing the sort of public disagreement, even though it may not show up on Russian national television, can it make those other international issues more troublesome for both leaders?
Well, it seems that Bush came here to Moscow on Sunday night. He was taken out to Putin's dacha outside of Moscow, and that they had a very constructive talk about those issues. I think that in Washington, they have decided to press the democracy thing and to push that for all it's worth. But they've also decided, at least this seems to be the upshot here, that they're going to retain good links with Moscow. I think that's the best way to explain Bush's rather tame behavior here in Moscow, giving Putin basically the scripted event he wanted, the parade and all that, and not making any waves.
All right, Fred, thanks for your help.
Yep, thank you, Dick.
Fred Weir, Russia correspondent with the Christian Science Monitor, joining us there on the line from Moscow. We're going now to the NPR studios in Washington, where Susan Glasser is joining us. Susan is also a former Moscow-based correspondent for the Washington Post. In fact, she and Peter Baker have collaborated on a new book about their years there. It's called Kremlin Rising, Vladimir Putin's Russia and the End of Revolution. Susan, it's good to have you with us.
Oh, thank you so much.
I need you to help explain this to me, because I remain puzzled by the fact that, as Fred explains, President Bush is quite happy to go and follow the script that's laid out for him while he is in Moscow. But as soon as he gets across the border in the former Soviet republics, he seems to be throwing these darts back at the Kremlin. Am I right to be puzzled about that or not?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's a contradictory relationship, and it has been from the beginning. But President Bush in particular is in a very awkward position. And I think what you're seeing is a very, you know, accurate reflection of a real debate within his own administration about Russia and what to do about it. And also the fact that he's sort of boxed in by so openly embracing Vladimir Putin. As you'll recall, back even at their very first meeting in 2001, he essentially took the measure of a guy that his aides were prepared to approach quite skeptically, and decided that, you know, he had looked into his soul very famously and said that this was his friend Vladimir, a man that he could do business with. So Putin and Bush have put a very personal cast to the relationship, and that's not so easy for the president of the United States to jettison, even though I think many of his advisors at this point would prefer to do that. And that's where I would take just slight issue with Fred, only in the sense that what we're seeing right now, I think, is not a full-throated attack by the White House on Putin, on the turn away from democracy in Russia, but a very awkward balancing act in which they try to maintain the personal friendship at the same time as they try not to get hammered politically back here in the United States for failing to recognize what's been going on in Russia.
Okay, so, follow along with me where we have been going with this, though, because you make the good point about how Bush and Putin seem to be soulmates back in 2001, but a lot has changed in the past 3 or 4 years in Russia. These are the years that you're marking in your book as the years when Putin really starts to clamp down to remove some of those elements of democracy. Isn't that right?
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, what the book, which is coming out next month, tries to do is to chronicle what we call and what his own aides called Project Putin, which is really the effort to bring this unknown KGB colonel into the Kremlin and then to consolidate power back in the Moscow center where it had been lost in the sort of chaotic breakup of the Soviet Union in 1991. And so, you know, what we looked at was a very systematic campaign, really, to retake over state television, for example, to make sure that there were no independent voices broadcasting across of Russia, to seize control, in a way, of the governorships, at first through appointing presidential envoys, and then when that didn't work to the Kremlin's pleasure, what they did was they used the pretext of the horrible massacre of schoolchildren in Beslan last year. They used that pretext to go ahead and cancel gubernatorial elections in all 89 regions of Russia.
Susan, I'm just going to stop you there because we have to take a short break. We'll continue when we come back. A reminder to Connection and listeners, we are taking a look at the changing relations between the U.S. and Russia as Putin consolidates his power in the Kremlin. How does that put pressure on President Bush to react to a diminishing democracy in that country? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Dick Gordon, you're listening to The Connection. Well, over the past few days, we've seen President Bush aim his sights directly at the lack of democracy in Russia. He did it when he was in the Baltic states. He did it when he was in Georgia. And then, curiously enough, when he was in Russia, he played it very close to his vest, not wanting to upset the celebration, the anniversary of the end of the Second World War that was put on by President Vladimir Putin. But in a large sense, what's happening in relations between these two countries? Is it going to be a very difficult thing for the President of the United States to try and navigate? 1-800-423-8255. We're going to take a call from Hilton Head Island in South Carolina. Michael's with us. Hi, Michael.
Hello, Mr. Gordon. How are you this morning?
I'm well.
Thank you for taking my call, and thank you for your pleasant emails. I have a lot of friends that are returning from Russia this year for their second tour here to spend 3 or 4 months working in the American, what do you want to call it, system of democracy and learning how we do things and so forth and so forth.
These are Russian citizens, right, Michael?
Yeah. Yeah. They're young. They're college students.
Uh-huh.
You know, they come over and flip burgers or do whatever jobs they can get. But to make a long story short, I've started to notice that as they email me, they're telling me that things in their country are starting to go backwards instead of forwards. Their newspapers are changing. A lot of the newspapers have closed down. You know, they're just not allowed to do and say the things that they were able to do just 2 or 3 years ago, and it's making them very nervous. So I just thought I'd throw that out there.
Are they saying as well, Michael, to you that they are looking for someone to stand up and say that the emperor is quickly shedding his democratic clothes?
If they did, they feel that person wouldn't survive to see the next sunrise.
That person in Russia?
Yes.
What about someone like President Bush? Does he need to take a more public stand saying this is not...
I think on the inside, Mr. Gordon, they'd love that, but I think they'd be too afraid to actually say it out loud.
Michael, thanks for your call. Susan Glasser, I know that in your time in Russia, you spent a lot of time actually speaking with ordinary Russians, trying to get their understanding of how close they came to democracy and what's happening now. Does Michael reflect the same kind of sentiment that you heard?
Yeah, I'm very interested by what the caller had to say, because I do think that what we've seen is a return of fear to a certain extent to public life in Russia that did not exist in the last decade. And, you know, in particular, I think people are concerned about organizing a viable opposition. In other words, it's not Brezhnev times again. You can make a joke about President Putin in your kitchen table and not worry that the KGB is going to come and haul you away. And that's why I think it's very important to understand that a lot of what's happening is what we call neo-Soviet, really, rather than Soviet. In other words, they are drawing a lot of tactics and familiar techniques from the old KGB playbook from the Soviet Union, but this is a modernized and updated for the internet era type of authoritarian government that Putin is trying to create. So, you know, I don't think, you know, we're talking about the real return to the bad old days, but to something, some new hybrid, really.
And when people in Russia are able to see what's going on in the former Soviet states like the Baltics, Latvia and Lithuania and Estonia, down to the south in Georgia, more recently to the west in Ukraine, do they look at developments in those countries with some wistfulness, that thinking that they could have that kind of life as well?
Well, that's a really interesting and provocative question right now, and that's certainly one that I think is keeping the Kremlin up at night. But my general sense, actually, is that Russians are very patriotic. And you have to remember that Russia was sort of the capital of empire, both in Soviet times and before that under the czars. And so, you know, countries like Ukraine or Georgia, these were outposts of empire. These were, in a sense, occupied countries for centuries. And so they have a very different attitude about what it means to throw off the yoke of the Kremlin than people inside Russia itself, where there is a broad longing and nostalgia for lost greatness, whether that greatness is defined as lost empire or the lost superpower status of the Soviet era. And I think I saw this across people of many different political orientations. Even what we would consider to be the more liberal democratic part of society had this sort of Russian patriotism or Russian chauvinism, some people might call it. And so I'm not sure that they look at Ukraine and say, oh, great, good for them. I think to a certain extent they view it as an embarrassment for Russia.
1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Sudbury, Massachusetts for our next call. Dimitri's with us. Hello, Dimitri.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. Thank you for calling.
I'm an emigre from Soviet Union from the 70s, and I have kept up with Russian politics, and I have friends in Russia, and I absolutely can attest that many Russians feel very uncomfortable, quite scared of the direction that Putin has taken. But at the same time, I want to point out that the reality of Russian-American relations is really very complex. First of all, I'd like to draw people's attention to the fact that the so-called color revolutions that have happened on the Russian periphery would not have been possible if not for massive influx of Western money and resources into the pro-Western institutions in those countries. So that's a sort of an interesting point to make.
Are you saying that the people in those countries, we'll talk about Georgia and Ukraine for two examples, were not or would not have been interested in it if it hadn't been helped along by Western?
Many were, absolutely. I would certainly say that there's a lot of public sentiment for those events and for those revolutions. But the West and United States in particular is playing a very facilitating role to a level financially and resource-wise that really borders on interference, perhaps, from a certain point of view. So that's one point to make.
Dimitri, I'm going to ask you to just hang on for half a second here, because a fellow by the name of Gia Nodia has been listening along on the program, and he's, in fact, chairman of the board of the Caucasian Institute for Peace, Democracy, and Development. It's a Georgia-based think tank. He's on the line from Washington, D.C. Gia, thanks for being with us.
Hello, Dick.
Quick reaction from you to what the point that Dimitri is saying here, that in fact the kinds of people's revolutions that have taken place in Ukraine and in your home country of Georgia, you know, might not have happened if it hadn't been for the interference, I think is the word that Dimitri used, of the West.
Okay, I would not use the word interference. I think that the West in general, United States in particular, has supported pro-democracy groups in Georgia, NGOs, sometimes independent media, and that of course had an impact. It was important in the sense that when you know, revolutionary times came, these revolutions were more orderly and better organized and in the end more peaceful. But of course, without, you know, real drive to democracy in these countries, it would not have happened.
Do you think, Gia, that the United States, in helping out a country like Georgia, is at the same time provoking Russia?
Okay, it's a choice of Russia to be provoked by such things. I think in modern world it's absolutely normal that there are, you know, relations between states and societies in other countries. And, you know, people's no, look after certain values and certain models in other countries, in developed democracies. And if Russia thinks that it is due to, you know, exclusively dominate countries in its neighborhood, then it will be provoked by any activism of other international players. But I think it should not be provoked by these things. It should take it as something normal in modern world.
Dmitry in Sudbury, back to you just briefly on this. Do you think that the U.S. End game here is to genuinely help out the democratic intentions of countries like Georgia, or do you think that there is something about sticking needles in the Russian bear here?
I think it's a very complex reality. I think the amount of money that's changing hands is so great, and the American resources are so much greater that can be mastered from any other side, that the balance can be decisively shifted by American involvement. And I'm not sure I'm against that. All I'm trying to say is this is the reality of the situation. And in the past, those American resources used to go to support dictatorships, to what was perceived as American benefits. Today, those resources are flowing very freely into these non-government organizations. What I'm worried about is that this amount of money that's changing hands is also being used for precisely and foremost the American benefit first, and whatever democratic benefits accrue to the other nations may be just a corollary to a larger geopolitical game that's being played out.
Susan Glasser, what do you think as you listen to Dmitry's analysis here?
Well, I think, you know, the point that the caller is making pretty much squares exactly with what you'll hear in Russia, and that is to say, you know, really echoes of Soviet-era propaganda and arguments where people say that the West is trying to encircle us and, you know, the nefarious, often unnamed forces of the West have become an increasingly prominent feature of President Putin's rhetoric. But I would just point out that, in fact, Russia, too, has tried to spend enormous amount of money to influence outcomes on the periphery. They just haven't been as successful in the places that we're talking about. Look at the Ukrainian revolution last year. What happened? In many ways, I think, you know, smart analysts who've looked at it would say the Russian involvement may have helped trigger the revolution and the success of the pro-Western democratic forces under Viktor Yushchenko. The Kremlin went all out in an effort to export its brand of managed, quote-unquote, democracy. In other words, controlled outcomes. They spent millions, untold millions of dollars to support the handpicked successor to the president. They openly campaigned for him. They even brought in President Putin several times right before the balloting to make the point that this was Russia's candidate. They brought their Kremlin political consultants to run the campaign of the Ukrainian candidate, and it didn't work. It backfired, in fact, very dramatically. So,
in a funny kind of way, Susan, it's like Back to the Future, where you have these two, you know, you have Moscow and Washington both trying to figure out where they can exercise their influence in the countries that exist between them.
That's right. It's Cold War era shadow boxing all over again, in a way.
I want to just ask one more question, if I can, to Gia Nadia, who's joining us from the Georgia-based think tank, the Caucasian Institute for Peace, Democracy, and Development. Gia, how dependent is Georgia on the continued assistance of the United States? Now that we've heard the president of the U.S. say, you know, look, we're behind you, how important will that be to Georgia in the years ahead?
I think it is important mainly in two senses. I think Georgia feels very vulnerable to Russia, especially provided Russia is quite unhappy with genuine independence for Georgia and does not like it. So Georgia relies very much on Western support and especially American support to balance this Russia's drive to dominate it. But also I think American support and close contact with America is important for strengthening democracy in Georgia, because on the one hand, Georgian people has demonstrated that it wants democracy, but on the other hand, we don't have entrenched, rooted democratic institutions. We don't have real experience of democracy, so it's very important for Georgians, for the government, or civil society organizations, for others to be in close contact with Americans, with Europeans as well, so that these democratic processes are really successful.
Yeah, as Peter mentioned earlier in the program, that there are still Russian army bases in Georgia, several thousand Russian soldiers who live in that country. Are there people in Georgia who fear that Russia might in fact use the military to maintain its control over the, over Georgia?
I think largely this Russian military presence is symbolic in nature. It annoys Georgians that Russia is there. It's not maybe direct military threat in the sense that Russia would, you know, use these bases as, you know, in terms of somehow trying to influence Georgian government through some military actions. But there is also other kind of fear. One of those bases is located in an area where there is ethnic minority and Armenian ethnic minority, and some Georgians fear that, you know, Russians may provoke some kind of grievances and discontents, expressions of grievances and in discontents that ethnic minorities may have, and this reminds of us of past history when Russia really supported Abkhazian and Ossetian ethnic nationalist forces against the government of Georgia.
All right, Gia, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Gia Nodjezza, chairman of a Georgia-based think tank, joining us there on the line from Washington, D.C. And Susan, I'm curious to know in your own sense of just how far Russia would go to try and maintain some influence over its near abroad, over the states that are on its borders. Can you imagine a time when Russia would use military strength to try and regain part of the Crimea, or to say to the Georgians, no, you must remain, or even the Armenians, the Azerbaijani? What do you think?
I think right now that's hard to conceive of, in part because I don't think the Russian military is really equipped to handle that. They've got their hands full in Chechnya. And, you know, as we took a fair amount of time in doing our book to look at the question of failure of Russian military reform, and it's a really sad story. This is an enormous army still, 1.1 million people, but it is really a shadow of its former self. It is, you know, unable even to feed properly, in many cases, its recruits. Under Putin, there's been an effort to restore this power somewhat. The military's budget has been going up every year thanks to those booming oil revenues. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, they really haven't made what experts consider to be meaningful progress in reinventing their military force. And to the extent that they have live action fighting units, they're pinned down in Chechnya in a very unstable and ongoing situation there. So I don't really foresee Russia swinging its military club as much as exercising its economic might in the neighborhood of what they call the near abroad.
Recent years, of course, we've seen Russia moving a lot closer to Western nations, turning the G7 into the G8. And in those kinds of clubs, I'm wondering if the tension that we're talking about on the program today will begin to start to show up, instead of all, you know, sort of gathering together and saying capitalism and democracy is the way forward. If that's not the tune anymore, does that mess up the other international meetings?
Well, I think it's a great question, especially looking ahead to, I believe, is next year when President Putin will assume the rotating chairmanship of the G8. At the same time that some influential Republican politicians here in Washington are calling for Russia to be kicked out of the organization entirely, saying it doesn't belong either because its economy is not actually big enough and because it's not really a democracy. So I think that you will see more and more awkward confrontations like President Bush's visit over the last few days, which really has, you know, thrown up all that mixed symbolism that is the relationship right now.
All right, Connection listeners, that mixed symbolism very much on display as we just take a look over the past couple of days. President Bush made a trip to Moscow, did not once open his mouth publicly, simply sat beside President Putin for the review of the Soviet era strength that was displayed on Red Square. That was part of something that was planned long ago. But also, Bush's criticism of President Putin, delivered both from the Baltic states and earlier today from the Georgian capital of Tbilisi, demonstrates that kind of mixed position that the U.S. has to take. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. How would you like to see President Bush dealing with a sort of diminished democracy in Moscow? Does he need to take a tougher stand? 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. You're listening to The Connection. My name's Dick Gordon. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Do you think it is realistic for people in this country to expect Russia to adopt a Western-style democracy? Is it reasonable for the U.S. president to make that kind of demand? What happens when that same U.S. president embraces democracies in the neighborhood and criticizes Russia at the same time? Does this take us back to Cold War times? 1-800-423-TALK. We're going next to Rockport, Massachusetts, and June's on the line. Hi, June.
Hello. I just wanted to raise a question.
Yeah.
I've learned a little bit about Putin lately and how he his beginnings and how he came to power, but I've also become aware of what they call the oligarchy in Moscow and in Russia. And I'm just wondering of the influence of this oligarchy and how much influence that has over what is happening over there and how much influence Putin really does have. I don't know the answer, but I just wondered about that and if anybody had any input on that.
Well, that's a great question. We have, in fact, not looked straight at that. Susan, maybe you can help June with this question of the relation between the extremely wealthy Russian businessmen, the people referred to as the oligarchy, and the politicians.
Well, in fact, this is a really important aspect of Putin's presidency, which is the effort to take power away from the oligarchs and bring it back into the Kremlin where he believes it properly resides. And that's been one of his key projects. Right now, Russia's formerly wealthiest man is sitting in jail where he's been ever since October of last year, of 2003. And he's about to be, what everyone presumes, convicted for tax charges and charges stemming from a privatization in the mid-90s of a company. Basically, most people believe this is a very politically motivated prosecution, that the idea was for the Kremlin to send a chilling signal to other businessmen, to other oligarchs who might think of meddling in politics, and the message was, stay out. They have effectively renationalized Mikhail Khodorkovsky's oil company, which was Russia's largest and most successful post-Soviet oil company. That's now essentially back in the hands of the state. And I think the message from Putin is very clear, which is to say, okay, guys, you can keep your money by and large only if you honor my terms of the New Deal, which is stay out of politics. And that's very different than under President Boris Yeltsin in the 1990s, when these businessmen effectively had privatized the Kremlin and they really ran things for their own benefit.
Does Putin have the people with him when it comes to confronting these oligarchs?
Well, that's exactly right. Of course, this is a wildly popular and populist ideal. The oligarchs are perhaps the most hated class of people in Russia today. They're widely perceived to have benefited where the rest of society did not in the 1990s, that, you know, a small handful of corrupt insiders received the vast wealth of Russia's natural resources, primarily oil, handed to them in the 1990s. They became billionaires almost overnight, these, you know, 30-something guys. And, you know, they're widely hated. So to bash them in politics is great politics in Russia.
I mentioned a little earlier, Susan, that you and Peter have a book coming out called Kremlin Rising. And in that, do you speak specifically to the point that the second point that June's asking, how much power does Putin really have today?
Well, I think that absolutely the book tries to address the question of not only what the Kremlin has done to take back control, but what are some of the weaknesses and what are some of the fears that they have? Why are they doing this? And one of the reasons I think that we conclude that Putin is doing this is because of their fear, the constant fear in Russia of revolution. And that's why the subtitle of the book is The End of Revolution. That was the project. That was the idea. Kremlin political consultant Gleb Pavlovsky said to me very early on in Putin's tenure, he said, you know, the goal of the Putin presidency is not to start a new revolution, but to end the old one. And I think that's what's been going on, is very much taking back as much control as they can because they know how unstable power in Russia is.
And Connection listeners, into this changing political atmosphere in Russia and the gathering of power in the Kremlin, U.S. President George Bush has to figure out what U.S. policy is. We're interested in your thoughts about how his administration is managing that. We're at 1-800-423-8255. We're going next to Raleigh, North Carolina, and Charlie's on the line. Hi, Charlie. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, Thank you, Dick, for taking my call. Mm-hmm. Did anybody ever stop to think that President Bush wants it both ways? He looks into the eyes of a KGB operative, for want of a better term, and he sees God or Jesus or whatever plane, ethereal plane he's on. It could be maybe Putin just wants to protect his country from crony capitalism. It went from crony communism, and now Bush is pushing crony capitalism all over the world. I read a good article in The Nation magazine. China's starting to rebel against the sweatshop conditions that exist there. Your guest said it best. The oligarchs are in charge, or were previously in charge in the Kremlin. The oligarchs are in charge in this country, obviously. Cheney won't release his energy task commission. Who did he meet with? You see,
you know, Charlie, when I think back to that time when Bush made the remark of sort of looking into his eyes and seeing his soul, I thought he was just trying to soften the man up with a little bit of Texas charm rather than really, you know, saying what he may have seen in the man's eyes. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, in my opinion, I think, you know, all of this is global capitalism, the worst of what we've ever seen. Believe me, I was not a fan of the Soviet Union. Crony communism and crony capitalism that we have emerging in this globe today.
But if that's the case, Charlie, then these two presidents, you would think, would agree on this.
No,
but
because ultimately the objective of any capitalist system that doesn't have government controls and regulations is to create an oligarchy, is to crush the competition. Look what's happening in this country with the consolidation of media and consolidation of other large industries. The objective is to pretty much create one entity as best you can, you know. So I just believe that everything we're seeing, I think in China you're going to start seeing, and you're seeing it already, people refusing this type of no union, no.
Charlie, I'm going to stop you there and turn to Susan on this. Not so much with what may be in the mind of President Bush, but just on the relations that exist now between the people who are in charge of business in Russia and people elsewhere in the world. When we hear these concerns about, you know, corporations running the world and globalization, is it reasonable to include the Russian oligarchs in that mix, Susan?
Well, I think they're a very unique and, you know, sort of historically specific class of people. And, you know, actually, the real story of the Russian economy since the collapse of the Soviet Union is that it really has not succeeded in being open to world business. And one of the effects of the Yukos case and the prosecution of Mikhail Khodorkovsky is to cause international businessmen great concern and great fear that Russia is not a place where they can safely do business, where the rule of law will protect them. And for better or for worse, they have come to the conclusion that China is such a place, even though it is still ruled by communist leaders. And so I think Russians look at China and they're wildly jealous, actually, of that recipe for success. But really, aside from natural resources, aside from oil, and the big international, multinational oil companies have made the conclusion that no matter how corrupt, they have no choice but to do business in Russia. Aside from them, I think many global companies have made the opposite conclusion, which is to say, it's too much trouble. We're not gonna go there.
Mm-hmm. All right, Connection listeners, this president has clearly made it his current policy to speak strongly in favor of the emerging democracies in countries like Ukraine and Georgia, as well as the Baltic states, the Kremlin, Moscow. People there seem to think that's a little bit provocative. Is that precisely what the president is intending? And is that what he should be doing in speaking out for freedom and for democracy? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. I'm taking a call next from Spokane, Washington. David's with us. Hi, David.
Hi. Thank you very much. Excellent discussion. See, my question centered around when we went into Iraq, Putin started asking questions about the loans that Russia had into Iraq, about $9 billion. He was told to forget it. That was Saddam Hussein's deal. Nothing would come of it. Shortly thereafter, a lot of the oil interests were privatized. I don't like the word nationalized. I just think that the privatization took place Russian style with the interests to the tune of about $9 billion, which I also understand some of the Texas oil people were invested in, some of these people that got busted by Putin. And I was just curious if I could get a comment on that.
Well, Susan, I remember early on in the debate over an invasion of Iraq, Putin being quite vocal in terms of saying that Russia had significant oil interests there. Looking at it now back through the lens of what we know over the past couple of years, what's the status of all that?
Well, it's a very good question. I think that, Russia was in the end opposed to the U.S. invasion of Iraq, and that was actually a great defeat for the Bush foreign policy team. They very much misread Putin in that situation, as we look at. It's one of the examples that we look at in our book, is how the Americans here in Washington thought that they could convert Putin or at least get him to stay quiet. But in fact, the French and the Germans, as you know, were leading the opposition to the war in Iraq, and they were very successful in getting Putin to come out publicly on their side. And the reason, one of the main reasons that Putin did so, was Russia's historic interest in developing the Iraqi oil economy and long partnership with Saddam Hussein. I think right now, they're considering it a loss, and probably they will not have many of those contracts that they made with Saddam Hussein honored in the long run.
But I'm actually glad that David made the point about the Russian interest in oil, because it's a useful reminder of just why or how it is, I think, that Putin can flex his muscle the way he is flexing it now, because, and you alluded to this earlier, Susan, he's got such significant oil revenues coming into the Kremlin coffers now.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, their own economy is essentially floating on petrodollars. And one of the questions that economists and people who are far smarter about this than I have right now is, to what extent has Russia become dangerously dependent on oil to float its budget? And what would happen in the case of oil revenues declining significantly? I think there's a very real concern that Russia may become, in a way, just another autocratic petrostate. And so that's a concern both about democracy and the economy. But it also tells you about Putin on the world stage. And the thing that he's got to throw around right now is not his aging and decayed military, but his incredible oil reserves in what is so far a relatively stable country outside of the Middle East.
Let's go to New Jersey for our next call. Gil's joining us on the line from there. Hello, Gil.
Yeah, I'm the former Secretary of Commerce for the state of New Jersey, and I also used to participate regularly in the World Economic Forum. So I had a chance to talk to a lot of policymakers in Russia and in different parts of the world, and it seems to me that President Bush is struggling with what I think are two legacies. One legacy is the legacy of Yalta, where the United States and the UK pretty much consigned Central Europe to decades of totalitarianism. The other legacy is the legacy of Boris Yeltsin, who initiated a revolution, but the revolution really, really got out of control. And you had basically chaos, the concentration of phenomenal wealth in the hands of a few people, and the impoverishment and loss of quality of life on the part of the vast majority of the Russian people. I'm a Republican, and I support President Bush on many issues, but I think that in trying to reconcile these two legacies, he's just not the balancing act is not what it should be.
Well, are you saying that for the past 60 years, and setting aside that big, great bulk of that time, which was the Cold War, but are we looking at Yalta and looking at Yeltsin, that the U.S. has consistently failed in many ways to provide Russians with that kind of clear guiding light on something like democracy? I mean, you talk about people during Yeltsin's time and the advice that they got from Harvard economists and stuff like that. They thought they were pretty well let down by the United States then.
Well, I agree, and I think during the Yeltsin era, we basically countenanced the chaos that ensued, the concentration of wealth, and really the impoverishment of a large portion of the population in Russia. Our advice was not good, and I think that President Putin is attempting to bring a little order out of the chaos from the Boris Yeltsin years in order to lay a foundation to build democracy and free enterprise in a constructive, organized fashion.
We're certainly capitalizing on people's discomfort of that particular time. Susan Glasser, just back to you on the recent history of U.S.-Russian relations. Do the Russians generally feel that they didn't ever get that much or the kind of help and assistance and guidance that they might have had from this country at a time when Russia was open to that?
There's no question that Russia, on the breakup of the Soviet Union back in 1991, was one of the most pro-American places that you could find. There was a great and very idealistic and, some would say now, very uninformed belief in the power of American-style democracy. And, you know, I think a very naive set of assumptions about what it would take to actually put that in place in Russia. And obviously, that isn't what happened. And now you see that the very word democracy itself is discredited in Russia, that people no longer believe in the word, that they have come to associate it with things like chaos, anarchy, and out-of-controlness. And President Putin has very skillfully played on that disillusionment, and he sold them a very particular solution to that. He sold them the idea that there has to be a trade-off, that Russia needs to revert to its historic course of a more autocratic, centralized form of government, and perhaps there will be trade-offs in terms of freedoms, but that order and stability are the necessary prerequisites for the next stage of Russian development. I think, you know, these two things are not inevitable, that Putin has been a very skillful politician, along with his advisors, at convincing people that this is necessary, that democracy is somehow not suited to the Russian people. And that's a very important point, I think, in understanding Putin's appeal as a political figure, is the success of that argument to the Russian people.
So when you quote the former Kremlin chief of staff, Voloshin, saying Russian people are not ready for democracy, if you took that out on a Tverskaya and tested that with people on the street, they'd say, yes, we're not ready for it?
Well, they might not want to look you in the eye and say that, but they would say something like what President Putin told a group of my American newspaper colleagues a couple of years ago when they asked him a question about democracy. What he said, I think, is what many Russian people on the street would say. He said, well, if by democracy you mean the dissolution and disintegration of the state, then we're not for that. Now, of course, no one except for Putin had defined democracy right in that way, but it's very telling, and I think a lot of Russians agree with President Putin on that subject.
Well, interesting questions for this administration in trying to figure out how then to deal with President Putin. He has years left in power. Susan Glasser, I want to thank you for being with us on the program.
Oh, thank you so much. This has been very interesting.
Susan and her colleague, Peter Baker, are authors of the upcoming book, Kremlin Rising, Vladimir Putin's Russia and the End of Revolution. Peter was joining us earlier in the program from Tbilisi in Georgia. We also spoke briefly with Fred Weir, Russian correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, and Gia Nadja, who's chairman of the Georgian think tank based in Washington. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.